I take very seriously the quantum Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime, and since there is so much literature about quantum field theory in classical expanding Friedman-Robertson-Walker, I would like to find some counterpart generalization of quantum field theory to our quantum expanding Friedman-Robertson-Walker. Let me start with the introduction to the background, to the quantum background geometry. And for this audience, I don't have to explain too much about this geometry. Nonetheless, for the sake of completeness, let us start. So our background quantum geometry consists of some dynamical framework, which is introduced in some kinematical Hilbert space. So let us start with kinematics. The kinematics consists of Hilbert space for scalar field, for homogeneous scalar field. So here I denote this homogeneous scalar field by capital T, which because this is just to indicate that it will play the role of time. I don't know if it is the best way to denote the scalar field. So in fact, this time will emerge later. But I know, knowing this, I already use this notation to simplify my future notation. So we have Hilbert space for this scale in which the states of the scalar field live with the usual scalar product and the operator representing the scalar field and the conjugate momentum. We also have another Hilbert space, which is the Hilbert space of quantum geometry. And here I didn't write any detail, because those operators which we use act in so complicated way. I would have to introduce non-separable Hilbert space, etc. And actually, everything what I will be doing today is independent on those details. So I just introduce only this amount of information which will be used in this work. So we have some quantum geometry which represents a Hilbert space in which the quantum geometry operator will be represented, A, the scale, and the corresponding momentum which doesn't explicitly emerge. So the total kinematical Hilbert space is this product of space for scalar field excitations and gravity and the scale factor, quantum scale factor, quantum excitations. Okay. Now, given that data from the previous transparency, in order to talk about some geometry, in fact, we need more ingredients. We need a three-manifold endowed with a homogeneous and isotropic conformal geometry and some compact closed region. In the case the manifold is compact, then this region is just the manifold itself. Then this operator, which was defined on the previous transparency. So now I'm using this a little awkward for physicist notation. My notation indicates whether operator is actually defined in this factor or in this factor. So the way to indicate this is to introduce such symbol. And now, by this I mean that this operator actually is defined in the factor in the factor Hilbert space on the right hand side. So this operator corresponds to quantum volume of this compact region, whereas this momentum of the scalar field T is in fact corresponds to the momentum coming from the full theory integrated along this region. And if you would like to reconstruct a quantum metric tensor, three-metric tensor, then this is the formula. We pick a representative of the conformal class, which is normalized such that its volume is 1, its fiducial volume is 1, and then from this we reconstruct a symmetric tensor operator. So this is all kinematics, and we already have some quantum geometry here. Now we go to dynamics. So we go to this real quantum expanding universe which satisfies quantum Einstein equations. Quantum Einstein equations are represented by a quantum scalar constraint. So this is quantum operator corresponding to the classical scalar constraint. This scalar constraint consists of two parts. The first part is just the kinetical energy of the scalar field, kinetic energy of the scalar field, whereas the second part is the gravitational part, and here I'm not explicit, I don't write this formula. We saw in several talks that this operator is kind of difference operator. However, everything what I will be doing today is independent on the actually the form of this operator, so we can just leave it like this. Now, an important step to define a solution to this, to define quantum state, is to using this operator to define what we mean by solution to the quantum constraint. So this quantum constraint operator, but how to solve it. Okay, so this is the part which I'm going to skip. But we have a nice, clear and simple proposal for this solution, which is in the literature, so I just refer to this. So a solution to this quantum constraint is a state which takes values only in this right factor, Hilbert space, but the values are dependent on some parameter t, and the equation which governs this dependence looks like the Schrödinger equation with a Hamiltonian operator which is constructed from this operator and somehow from this operator. So here it looks a little awkward, a to minus 3 hat to minus 1. One could just reduce those powers in suitable way. But here I was trying to be general enough to also take into account that in loop quantum cosmology, operator corresponding to inverse scale factor is not necessarily inverse of the operator corresponding to the scale factor. But this subtlety also doesn't matter to me now. So those who work on simplified loop quantum cosmology can just consider this as a hat to minus 3, and those who prefer the usual Tiemann's trick can consider this as distinct operator from the inverse of A. Okay,
there was talk yesterday a lot, and it's good to say that the H hat GR was exactly what was called theta yesterday.
Yes, and yesterday this was called theta. So I'm sorry for not calling this theta. Theta here.
So how it is assumed that it's an inverse of the three?
Yes, because we have explicit formulae for this operator, there are two inversions here actually. So in some cases we even don't have to worry about this inversion. In some cases the answer is yes, all the subtleties here are solved and this operator makes sense. Here Ashtekar, Pawłowski and Singh, they modify this scalar product in this Hilbert space such that this operator is self-adjoint. Otherwise, if you don't want to modify the scalar product, you have to modify this operator and here define different factor ordering such that we maintain the same scalar product, but this operator is symmetrized suitably. Okay, so this is the dynamical formulation of quantum expanding Friedman-Robertson-Walker. And now, so this is definition of quantum states. Now, what are quantum operators which we can use? The first operator which already was used is the field moment, the scalar field momentum. So in the space of solutions, it exactly equals. Sorry, I think here. No, it's okay. So just according to this equation, this is this PT and this is H. So on physical solutions, we just identify this operator with this operator. So whenever we want to act with this operator, we use this operator. And this operator is invariant with respect to this evolution defined by this equation. So it's constant, kind of constant of motion, which is also classically constant of motion. So it's an agreement. On the other hand, the scale operator can make sense only if we define an instant of t at which it is applied. So we have Dirac observable, if you want, defined by this operator. And this Dirac observable can be formally, explicitly written like this. And in words, it means that we take a state psi, take its value at t0, and then apply the operator A. And then look for a new state which takes this value at t0. So this is what this formula says. So we have a well-defined Dirac observable corresponding to the scale operator at any instant of time. From this, we can construct the evolving three-dimensional metric tensor. Okay? Now, what about the four-dimensional metric tensor? So let us go back to classical formula for the four-dimensional metric tensor. So here, this time t is completely is general. It is not a priori this. But now we realize that we use this time, so we do some calculation which uses the Klein-Gordon equation on the scalar field t. And from this we calculate that this term, which is in charge responsible for this part of the metric tensor, has this form exactly in terms of the fields. So if we still classically write metric tensor in terms of our classical observables, which later are quantized, it has this form. Okay, but as you remember, this is the Hamiltonian operator. It doesn't commute with A. So if we want to, if one really insists to define this operator in quantum, corresponding quantum operator, then one has to make some choice how to order this factor. So it can mean that there is no well-defined metric tensor in quantum theory, that we just don't need it, or that there is a well-defined metric tensor, but we need some extra information. A third possibility is that we can improve this framework such that this time is better defined in the quantum theory, which we also have some. There are some proposals which we consider how it could be done, but I'm not going to talk about them today. Okay, so now we would like to probe this quantum space-time with a scalar field. So you could be concerned that because the four-dimensional metric tensor is not really well-defined, so it will... You may be afraid that those ambiguities will propagate to whatever we do. And if it was the case, then we would do anyway what we would like to do. However, it's not the case. So it turns out that actually when we try to do quantum field theory in this quantum space-time, that we will in some sense go around those difficulties. So we will understand this space-time geometry better because we will not have to make any choice of ordering for that metric tensor, and still we will uniquely derive our evolution of our quantum fields in this quantum space-time. Okay, but before we...
Are you considering
So for the time being, I've been considering only background, and I didn't consider any other scalar field. And now I will consider, on this background, I will consider a scalar field which is not homogeneous any longer. But the background will be still homogeneous. So let us go first to the classical geometry case. What do we do in a classical curved spacetime? So in classical curved spacetime, we have a metric tensor. So suppose that we quantize Klein-Gordon field. Then the quantization of Klein-Gordon field amounts to finding operator distribution which is solution to this equation and which satisfies this commutation relation where G is coming from the classical theory. It is just direct quantization of the Poisson bracket. If I remove I and write here the Poisson bracket, it will be the correct Poisson bracket between two classical Klein-Gordon fields. So we just do this direct replacement of Poisson bracket by quantum bracket, assume that field is real, and then a quantum state is a way of assigning to product of operators some number. If there was anybody mathematically sensitive in the audience, then there is a one-page definition of quantum field theory in curved spacetime, which is actually quite exact. So it means that it's just instruction, the algorithm. We have to construct certain star algebra using letters which are labeled by functions on spacetime. And this algebra has to satisfy certain relations without this segment, and this relation and this relation. And mathematicians know how to define a most general algebra, which biggest algebra which satisfies such relations. And this is yet one more relation. So now that having this algebra, we can define a quantum state just as a positive linear functional defined on this algebra. So this is all, and the rest is what we do in physics is we try to come up with various recipes for this state, and this is where all the details become relevant. Okay, and just for sake of completeness, in physics we usually use Fock states. So this notation is very general. Here we have also thermal states and possibly some other states. Whereas Fock state is also a specific choice of a state, and this Fock state can be defined in the following way, that we look for a family of solutions to classical solutions to this equation, family labeled by points of some measurable space. However, this family of solutions has to satisfy certain consistency condition, which again comes from this classical Poisson bracket. And then, given a family of solutions which satisfies this, we construct the state by applying certain recipe, which is the... So we start with... For odd products, it is zero, and for even products, we start with defining product for a couple, and then for a higher for 2n factors, we assume that the Weak formula should be satisfied, and we use it as definition of this state. And again, we know that in expanding spacetime, still this definition doesn't solve the problem. There is a huge class of fog vacuums, and we don't know which one is better than another one. Okay, so now we try to generalize this to the quantum geometry. And of course, my first thought was to somehow go through these formulae and then replace metric tensor by operator and somehow use some shortest way of generalizing this formula, but it's not so simple. You encounter some problems. So for this reason, I decided to do it. This it was mentioned at the beginning. This is work by three people, by a student of mine and myself. So the first step is to formulate quantum field theory in curved spacetime, in the case of Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime, in a way which is compatible with the framework of loop quantum cosmology. It means with the canonical framework. So once it is formulated in the same framework, then we can look for generalization. So what it looks like in canonical framework? In canonical framework, once again, we are talking about the classical, pseudo-classical metric tensor. For simplicity, I assume that that the slices are compact, and that this is three torus, because then this family of modes will be countable, and it's a little easier. This is the only reason. So now, a quantum field is represented by a family of quantum modes. And each quantum mode is a certain quantum system. It's labeled by triples of numbers, like this. And to each triple K, we assign a Hilbert space. And operators, position and momentum operators, as in the usual quantum mechanics. Hamiltonian, which has this form, where A, the coefficients come from this, and N is this. And we impose the Schrödinger equation by using this as time-dependent Hamiltonian. So we can do a quick calculation that in our case we know what is this Laplace function. So in our case we can choose for time this capital T. For Laplace function we choose this because this was our Laplace function. And then you can derive this Hamiltonian takes this form, where this is a constant of motion. This is this constant P, this momentum of the homogeneous scalar. Now, if you want to construct from my Qs and Ps a scalar field, what you have to do is you have to fix on every direction in the space of Ks. You have to orient every direction in the space of Ks and call a point K and minus this. They get pair K and minus K and take operators which come from the Heisenberg picture of this system, operators Q and QK and Q minus K, take such where this X is the same X as here. So then you get some distribution on defined on space time, which takes values in this Hilbert space. And if we sum with respect to all the k's, then we have the scalar field operator. So this is the relation between the usual notation and here those simplified modes. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to generalize this to the quantum space. So now you could be almost sure that the simplest thing we can do is just to replace this by hat A, and also replace this by hat, but we are aware of those ordering problems. So we would have to choose some ordering, but perhaps we can do better. Maybe we can actually derive this formula with some ordering which will follow from our derivation. So that's why I still don't want to just replace mechanically classical factors by operators, because I don't completely trust this procedure. I want to derive it from some, have an impression that I'm deriving it from some more general theory. Okay, so here is our idea. Let us consider gravitational fields. For a moment, let us think we are doing general theory, which is coupled with two Klein-Gordon fields. There are still other choices of the Laplace function. There is still the diffeomorphism constraint. But let us for a moment consider only this scalar constraint with this choice of the Lapse function, and consider a point about which we will be perturbing. So it's actually a surface which consists of homogeneous isotropic solutions as the one which was used in the previous transparency. So it consists of homogeneous gravitational field, homogeneous isotropic, homogeneous scalar field, and let us set this second scalar field to zero. So this is our background, and this is a solution, general solution to this theory. And now we'll be considering perturbations.
Setting both phi and phi phi.
Hmm?
Setting both phi and phi phi, not just phi phi.
Yes, both of them. Yeah. Okay, if this phi was this t, then I would do maybe something else. But now I'm considering a case when this field is a different field than this. So that's why, since we didn't talk about this field before, I'm assuming it was zero, and now we will consider this phi as perturbation. So here, that's some technical assumption. We can assume that perturbations of some parts of metric tensor and of the homogeneous field T are kind of orthogonal to one. So assuming this, we now perturb the scalar field. And then we can so those powers here, 2, 3 mean so this 2 means that we have some expression quadratic in with respect to those deltas, and 3 means that we have some expression which is always cubic in deltas, etc. So we obtain zeroth order term and the second order term, which corresponds to which is just the Hamiltonian of this scalar field. Here I drop this delta when I talk about fields. So here I did actually two steps. I decompose this scalar constraint corresponding to this scalar field by using the Fourier transform and by using my definition of mode into those modes. For some reasons, collision of notations. Actually, pi is p and phi is q. I'm sorry. So there should be q and pi. And some other fields. Okay, and now when I look at the equations of motion up to the first order, then all I have to do, I have to satisfy this constraint up to the first order, which means just this constraint. And the dynamics of the modes is given by this equation. Classic. However, we learned from Abbe's model, from quantum Friedman Robertson Walker, that if we go to quantum theory, then this is not the best way of discovering the quantum dynamics. A better way is to impose the constraint and then wait until it emerges. Time emerges, everything emerges. So let us do the same. So instead of quantizing this, because in fact it's not clear how to exactly quantize this, let us consider a theory which is just given by the first two terms, by this term and one, thus select one term corresponding to one mode. So physically we're ignoring interaction between different fields.
You are ignoring the interaction between these modes, but you're also ignoring the effect. Can you go back to the last one? You have two terms which are of second order, right? And you're ignoring the other term. Right. And ignoring the other term means that you are not changing the background geometry. Is that right? Okay. So in this
approximation, we don't change the background geometry. However, we will find it convenient to let this quantum geometry interact with our scalar. So what is relevant in this approximation is this part of geometry which is not affected by our scalar fields. However, we will let it be affected just for mathematical reasons, because then we will have nicer properties.
Is this the best field approximation? I would not.
Okay, so we are doing test field approximation, but it turns out that it's not the same. It's not as it doesn't have all the features we are used to. It turns out that if this background geometry is quantum, then we cannot really ignore this big reaction which test field has on quantum geometry. Or at least this back reaction somehow is there, and it gives us clues how to go on. And we can always ignore it. We can always go to approximation if we don't want it, in which it is ignored. So it means that we use some higher order corrections in our framework, which we find convenient.
You're still ignoring C other. You're still ignoring this C other, and you get some other.
Yes, unless we include two test fields, then we will have this. We will see this interaction between them.
But he's saying that you're ignoring C others. That is to say, you're not changing the geometry. That's what it means.
I'm ignoring what?
C other, C two other.
Oh, I see. Yes, I'm ignoring this.
So that means that you're not.
Yes, I'm ignoring this. However, I mean, I hope that, I mean, some of them probably can be by themselves, if I even ignore all this term, probably some of them can be quantized on this quantum background in similar way.
And what to consider is that two and a half of pi depends on the cage anyway, so if you say you ignore it, you could also say you assume that the field is just zero.
Okay, what gauge transformations do you need?
Space-time gauge transformations. They would change if you change coordinates, you change delta p. If it's zero in one coordinate system, it could be non-zero in another.
Okay, if q was this gravitational part, then it would be sensitive on. Okay, yeah. But in my case, this is a Klein-Gordon field, so it's scalar with respect to the coordinate transformation. So I'm considering the easiest possible perturbation, which is scalar with respect to this coordinate transformation.
Okay, but
there was a question?
Yeah, I think it's an answer, but the question was
something
that you consistently
stay
in the second order,
and
the answer is yes, but then you're ignoring some
of that second order. Yes. Okay, so I just focus on one mode of scalar field, which is not one of those which okay. So we considered theory with this scalar constraint. So now the kinematical Hilbert space is product of three Hilbert spaces of this homogeneous scalar field, gravitational geometry, so this is the background, times this new mode. And the quantum fields act in the corresponding factors, so we have two new quantum fields. And the constraint operator consists, this is the C0 part, and this is the C2 part. And now our states are solutions to this constraint, so they take values in the product of those two, gravitational and the K-mode Hilbert space. And just by doing the same, understanding this constraint in the same way as in the Friedman-Robertson-Walker case, we derive the equation which has this form. Now, if we don't want to deal with the square root, we can still consider this part as small. We can still remember that this part should be considered as perturbation, and then we expand this square root. It's one has to use some operator identity. So this operator identity turns this with this under the square into one plus some operator, and then those two commute, so we can expand the square root in the known way. And then the result is our generalized Schrödinger equation, which has this form. This is the old term, which was in the quantum Friedman-Robertson-Walker case, and there is a new term here, which is given by this Hamiltonian of the of the K-mode, rescaled by this factor H, which actually comes from this factor pi. But since we remember that pi was actually the same as H, so this innocent factor pi now becomes this operator, which will be present in all the formulae, and which doesn't commute with A. Okay, so now to understand better and compare what we derive, it's convenient to go to the interaction picture. So I didn't write the definition of the interaction picture, but going to interaction picture means allowing psi to evolve in such a way that this first term is killed. So we replace psi by some evolving psi, which such that if we take this derivative, this first term is killed, and this new psi is called psi interaction picture. And then the new Hamiltonian which we have is a little different. It changes, and did I use those alphas and betas? Yeah, I'm sorry for using those alphas and betas. They follow from this fact that not always inverse is operator of inverse is inverse. But if we assume the simplest case that this is the same as this, then alpha is a to power 4 and beta is a to power 6, or vice versa. I don't remember this point. I think it's the correct definition. Okay, so it takes familiar form, and now,
sorry, it's still not this.
This was an interaction picture. And now the components start evolving according, so now this operator, which was constant, now it evolves according to the quantum geometry evolution, according to pure quantum geometry. This is background geometry evolution. So those components they evolve. Okay, so let us compare with the classical case, and let us see what is different and what is new. Okay, so we have this in the interaction picture, this Schrödinger equation. Green corresponds to the classical background spacetime, and it was this familiar harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian with frequency depending on time and involving the classical scale factor. Now, in this quantum case, so quantum is black, we see that we still see this familiar form, but now now we have an extra Hilbert space, so those factors become operators, and still this factor is actually split into two pieces, but it wasn't my choice. It was the result of some operator identity. So actually one could say that the only difference is that this, as expected, that this A becomes operator. And perhaps we learned a little how to order this product, because this doesn't commute with this in the quantum case. So what we learned from this derivation is that we know how to split this product. Okay. So, however, there is, as you will see, there is still a difference. So one could, looking at this algebraically, from an algebraic point of view, one could say that this is just the result is just an easy generalization of the classical case. And one could also ask, one could also think that we don't have any big reaction here. So one could think, okay, we have A evolving according to the background Friedman-Robertson-Walker evolution. This A doesn't know about Qs, and we have this Schrödinger equation. So one could think that we still are in this, that we don't have any background reaction on A. However, if we go to the Heisenberg picture, so we introduce this holonomy given by this time-dependent operator and turn operators into the Heisenberg picture operators, then the Schrödinger equation is turned into this Heisenberg equation. However, now we have Hamiltonian in the Heisenberg picture. So let us see what happens with time-dependent Hamiltonian in Heisenberg picture. So in quantum mechanics, where coefficients are time-dependent, going to Heisenberg picture amounts to replacing positions and momenta by their Heisenberg picture. The coefficients are unchanged. Okay, but in our case, the coefficients are operators. So when we go to the Heisenberg picture, then in classical case, U commutes with those coefficients and it doesn't affect. However, here, U cannot go through this coefficient. And that's why the Heisenberg picture of this Hamiltonian operator, now it includes some small amount of big reaction of this scalar. So, okay, but it's not surprising because we allowed for this. So we can again eliminate this by assuming that we just ignore and that this Heisenberg evolution. So if somebody is unhappy, he can just remove this letter H from the transparency, and then we have this Robertson-Walker background evolution of those operators A, and this is constant, and we don't have a big reaction. But if we keep this a little amount of big reaction, the advantage of this is that then the Heisenberg picture preserves the commutation relation. Otherwise, this commutation relation would be violated. So if we really stick to no big reaction formula, then we violate this commutation relation. If we want to improve this commutation relation and pay smallest possible price, then we just allow this scale factor to fill this single mode. Well, because by assumption, this mode Q. So, when we do test field approximation, then we always have to remember that when our test fields grow to big, then we are already not in our regime of approximation. So, but as long as effect of this Q is small, then the effects of this big reaction will be also small. Okay, so we can repeat the same for finitely many modes, but then the result we will have is a little different than talking just about the single mode, because then this scale factor will know about all the modes. So through this scale factor, actually those modes will also talk to each other a little. Okay, but if you guys don't like it, there is one more way out. We can do semi-classical approximation. So in the semi-classical approximation, in this zeros or first relevant order, we assume that the state in the interaction picture has the following form. The gravitational part is constant, because interaction picture means the same as going to Heisenberg picture with the gravitational part. And in the Heisenberg picture, the state is constant. So this gravitational part is constant, times some unknown scalar field part, okay? And then we take expectation values of everything with respect to this gravitational part. And so by this, I mean taking expectation taking trace, kind of tracing this in this Hilbert space corresponding to gravitational.
So this is not just coming to part of the infinite space time, but from above.
Right.
In other words,
you're
operators, but then wherever there is geometry, you're replacing it by spectacular.
Yes. And then I obtain, as Abhay said, system of equations similar to this in classical geometry, because now this psi takes values only in the Hilbert space of scalar field, of case mode. Okay, the Hamiltonian, all these gravitational operators are replaced by expectation values in this state. Okay, however, taking these expectation values is, those expectation values are sensitive on, it's not the same as product of expectation values, we know well. So there are some quantum effects in those expectation values. Okay, so now we can ask, so it looks semi-classical, however, it's not absolutely obvious that in fact there is a classical geometry which produces such equations. So let us ask this question. So does classical geometry emerge in the semi-classical picture? So let us recall, classical geometry was this, and the classical Hamiltonian was this. And now we have this quantum Hamiltonian, so it has the same form, but we have to solve some equations. We have to find the classical fields from these expectation values. So what we have to do is we have to solve some equations. Here we have a constant, which is given. Okay, so the expectation values are given. And we are looking for, it should be also green. Right? And we are looking for N and A. So we have two equations. So we can solve those equations unique. But this is the case, the massless case. Now, in the massive case, we still have coefficients proportional to mass. And then they give us, if we are done with this part, they give us some consistency condition. And this, and in general case, for general state of background geometry, this condition will not be satisfied. So you see, if we remove this quantum heads, then those two expressions should be identical. They should reduce to the same expression. But there is difference in which those... But here we take expectation of the, here we have a to the 4, and here 3, here we have a to the 6, and here we have power 2. So we know that in general we have quantum fluctuations, dispersions, and this is not really true. So it means that as long as mode is massless, then actually we can calculate a single classical geometry for this mode. Whereas if it's massive, then actually no. Then we can see some quantum departures from this. And okay, so this is it. But we have less conditions. In massive case, we have this coefficient to match and this coefficient to match. In massless case, we don't have this condition. So actually, each of these conditions is sufficient to calculate A. However, each of them gives a little different A. So if we don't have this term, then we uniquely calculate A. But if we have this term, then we have two different A's. One which is two different classical scales. One given by this and one by this, which differs due to... That would mean that... So the question is, how can this quantum mode define this A? So if you are this quantum mode, you don't know about A at all. You know only about this equation. So this quantum mode knows about this equation. And if he knows a little of general theory, he can try to calculate this A by looking at the coefficients of the Schrödinger equation, which is defining the evolution. So I use this as definition of classical A, because there is no other way this quantum mode can define this classical A. And you have some, if you have some other process in terms of which you can define this A in a different way, then you may find a different A. Okay, and using this semi-classical limit, we can actually take infinitely many modes, and we don't have to restrict to a single finite set of quantum modes. We can talk about all the scalar field with all the infinities in it. So it's all well defined. Okay, what are open problems? So a counterpart of for creation annihilation operators, which naturally emerges from this picture, looks like this, in the massless space at least. So, oh, sorry, I missed this k squared there, so the k squared. And the question is if we can understand the algebra of those operators acting in this kinematical, in this product Hilbert space, and if they define, and if we can find a nice definition of vacuum from those operators. Accommodating infinitely many modes would be appreciated. And so I tend to think of this as a first step to considering the full theory, to expanding the full theory in around this background. Finally, we discussed with Abai some ways of, by looking at this framework, we noticed that actually there is a certain improvement of the quantum Friedman-Robertson-Walker model, which would make this framework easier. So depending on whether we test this improvement and whether the result is positive, we will maybe consider some improved version. Thank you. You mean this homogeneous?
Yeah.
So then I would have to go back to the background model and work out the background model itself first, and then. Well, this is so. You say that I can consider for this homogeneous field. I can consider potential which still.
It doesn't have to have a minimum. I mean,
which doesn't spoil this property as time.
No, I see.
Okay, but since I didn't have such model at hand, I just use. I don't know, this is a question about the background model itself. So I know that Abai probably considers this model with some potentials. I don't know if
you have potentials, then you won't have globally well defined time or a general potential.
No, well, maybe let's say that potential is like the t to the power of minus n. So we can still define this time for a thing. Bring it to mathematics.
is, I really, morally, what one should think about this is really that there's only one scarcity, and its homogeneous mode is playing the role of time, chi.
Yes.
And the inhomogeneous modes, which are perturbations, are the ones which are the formation. So that's how I really think about this whole thing. So that's what you're suggesting. And but to do that, you have to divide the whole problem into sections. In other words, there's the imaginary part and then the future part, etc.
Well, I mean, the future part doesn't matter. I mean, you want to see quantum effects there through Kirikitnik. Is that a view that you said rather low?
So, I mean,
you can even say that this perturbation field is massless, it doesn't matter.
But if you want, during reheating, not just up to reheating. So during reheating, the inflaton is supposed to go back and forth.
Yeah, yeah. But you want to just have any quantum effects in there, I mean.
Okay, good.
So that's
a very practical cosmologist attitude. And I think this framework is quite well tailored to do that, exactly what you want to do. Up to reheating, and then seeing what that. And that's exactly how I think about it, right? Physically.
Well, I mean, you could say that you have initial conditions around the planet. I mean,
no, you can answer that. Your answer is not confirmed with you.
Oh, good. I mean, you can have a potential, like just a starship with a mass. You can take the initial conditions for a. Around the Planck scale, and if you say that mass is around 10 to the minus 5 Planck mass, then you have a CMP.
I'm not sure. But anyway, this question is already for you.
But I agree that on one hand, this regime when volume is has Planck scale is important for some other reasons, but from the point of view of my talk, I would be happy with a model which doesn't really explain the Big Bang, but which is just homogeneous isotropic geometry, which corresponds to some other period of expansion. So it could be potential which we can see away from Big Bang when we are far away. Just doesn't matter.
I think that perhaps you need to think about the energy scale in which you have in which the perturbations are being frozen outside the horizon, the perturbations are contracted. So the cluster of galaxies, and this is truly like the 16 GeV, but I mean this last 60 EVs, and the inflation can go for thousands of EVs. You could have a.
Okay, but tomorrow we will have a session on all this stuff. So it's a question for tomorrow's session on the inflation.
I'm not even confused because I thought that the whole idea is that you're treating this pi as time, but in the standard inflation you need pi as function of time. So I'm really confused how can this.
I don't know what is in inflation and what is standard inflation. This is not about inflation. So as the previous question, this is a question.
So what is it? Usually, you have everything depends on time. There is a time, and then there is another scalar field which is depending on time, which has a particular potential, whatever that potential. Let's just consider that. But here, I thought in this approach, the T field is supposed to So how can that be? I mean, time is not the inflation of the standard state. So you need another pi, which is a function of time, and it has a particular evolution in order to give you this exponential phase. So how can you? I mean, it is possible, but it's not clear how you are going to do the job of the inflation and time by.
That's exactly the point. And so the statement is that somehow you were doing time. The PG has still enough energy. We should talk about this. But that's the reason why you reckon that two scalar fields.
Right.
One is T and the other is
5.
Yeah,
but coming to
the point,
I think the 2 point here is that actually very interested in the correlation. Like, we want to ask the question, what is the amplitude of scalar perturbations at any one time?
Well, pi.
Yes.
That's
all about given energy scale. And we don't require proper time.
No, that part I completely understand. Yes.
So they can still circumvent all these issues.
If you treat pi as an integral field, you can actually probably address some of the initial condition on the quantum transition, those kinds of issues. Very nicely.
Yes, so I think that's the simplest way to look at it at this stage. Other way, it's not something that's completely compound. So.
And that is actually often done in classical cosmology. If you just use pi itself, it's not a kind of order.
So you mentioned that the interaction picture, the gravitational center, you get an effective space-time which you incorporate also correct. I wonder if you have looked into what the difference between this effective space-time and standard light movement by conventional GR.
You mean this back reaction of the scalar field, which I take. Right. No, I didn't study this. So yes, you are right that we have some operator. So now the dependence of operator A on T is kind of different. But one would have to get rid of this scalar mode. I don't know how to do it. So it's a good question, but I don't know how to, not only how to answer this question, but even how to work on this, how to find a solution. But it's maybe it's possible.
You used this operator identity to basically derive your factor.
Could you explain what you're doing? The identity was kind of trivial. So the only problem is when you deal with this kind of analytic functions of operators is that if operators don't commute, then you cannot do what you are used to. But so the idea is to turn this formula into an analytic function of commuting operators. So if we just factor half of A to the left and half of A to the right, then you have 1 plus some sort of joint operator. And then for this parenthesis inside, we know what to do. The usual formula which we know is correct. So this was this identity.
But is that the only way you can split up this operator?
I'm asking myself the same question. I don't know if it's the only way, but it's the correct way. So if it's
for example, if you go a third of A from one side to a third of A to the side.
I will think about
that. The other thing, but there is some physical idea here that A corresponds to this geometry and B corresponds to. Maybe you should go back to.
But here I was trying not to use any. Okay. Oh, I mean, it was clear what was supposed to be small and what was big. So A is this, and it is assumed to be big. And this is B, and this B is small. So I want to expand with this. So this is what breaks the symmetry between A and B. I mean, when I was doing this, I didn't know it will be relevant. It will give me this preferred ordering choice, so I just did it because it was correct. So it was correct thing to do, so why shouldn't I do it? I don't know how one can prove that there is no other correct way of doing the same thing. Right. Yeah, that's true. The issue is how I define those terms. Which
They are
higher order in B.
Yes.
Right.
So I guess in terms of the choice you have, that you're always
they all contain one factor of B, and then to make B how you break vector A is they all the same answer as that. That would be
so can you see any other choices following from this? But on the other hand, if the instrument which I mentioned and which was not shown, which will work, then we exactly it will exactly solve this problem which we have here, and we will not have to take any square roots, and it will be much simpler. But we have to understand if it is correct for some other. So there is a way of doing this without the square root, such that what we derive comes out without the square root. And then it's very easy to truncate some small terms, which we consider small.
So once you drop these terms, it's no longer an operator, because whether or not these terms are small depends on the state, whether that is really a test field or not. So
yes.
It's only true on a certain subspace of the other space.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I think spirit is very much like a test field of perturbation. And which, I mean, one does this, then one gets some equations. Of course, if you just work with those equations, you will never, by itself, start consistent. Of course, it's a perfect. The solutions can also be such that if you draw it compared to the background, then you just can't trust it anymore. The same thing is here, maybe there's a theory, but you just can't trust it.
Thank you once again, first.